Helmet under his arm, he ducked into the tent to find what must have been most of the camp's officers gathered around a large map spread out on a folding camp table. Half wore segmented breastplates lacquered in horizontal red and blue stripes, the other half red and yellow. They straightened and stared when he walked in. Men from Koeyal or Dalinshar, with skin blacker than charcoal. Honey-brown men from Nakhon. Fair-haired men from Achakan. Pale-eyed men from Elkam. Men from every part of the Empire. Their stares held not the wariness often tinged with admiration that he had always been used to, but very nearly challenges. It seemed everyone believed the filthy tale of guards' involvement with a girl pretending to be the High Lady Tuan and extorting gold and jewels from merchants. Likely they believed that other whispered tale about the girl, not merely vile but horrific. No. That the High Lady was in danger of her life from the ever-victorious army itself went beyond horrific. That was a world gone mad. "Ferek Karid," he said coolly. His hand wanted to go to his sword hilt. Only discipline kept it at his side. Discipline and duty. He had accepted sword thrusts for duty. He could accept insults for it. "I wish to speak to the commander of this camp." For a long moment, the silence stretched. "Everybody out!" a tall, lean man barked at last in the sharp accents of Dalinshar. The others saluted, gathered their helmets from another table, and filed out. Not one offered Karid a salute. His right hand twitched once, feeling a phantom hilt against his palm, and was still. "Gamel Luna," the lean man introduced himself. Missing the top of his right ear, he had a slash of solid white there through his tight black curls and flecks of white elsewhere. "What do you want?" There was the barest touch of wariness in that. A hard man and self-controlled. He would have had to be to earn the three red plumes decorating the helmet atop his sword rack. Weak men without mastery of themselves did not rise to banner general. Karid suspected the only reason Luna was willing to talk to him was that his own helmet bore three black plumes. "Not to interfere in your command." Luna had cause to fear that. Ranks in the Death Watch Guard stood half a step higher than those outside. He could have co-opted the man's command had he needed to, though he would have been required to explain his reasons later. They would have had to be good reasons for him to avoid losing his head. "I understand there have been difficulties in this part of Altara recently. I want to know what I am riding into." Luna grunted. "Difficulties? That's one word for it." A stocky man in a plain brown coat, a narrow beard dangling from the point of his chin, entered the tent, carrying a heavily carved wooden tray with a silver pitcher and two sturdy white cups, the sort that would not break easily while being carried about in wagons. The scent of freshly brewed cough began to suffuse the air. "Your cough, Banner General." Setting the tray on the edge of the table holding the map, he carefully filled one cup with the black liquid while watching Karid from the corner of his eye. Somewhere in his middle years, he wore a pair of long knives at his belt, and his hands had a knifeman's calluses. Karid sensed close kin to Ajimbura, in spirit but not in blood. Those dark brown eyes never came from the Kainsada Hills. "I waited till the others left, since there's hardly enough for you anymore. Don't know when I'm going to get more, I don't."
"Will you take cuff, Karid?"
Luna's reluctance was obvious, but he could hardly fail to offer. For an insult that large, Karid would have been forced to kill him, or so the man would think.
"With pleasure," Karid replied.
Placing his helmet alongside the tray, he doffed his steel-backed gauntlets and laid them beside it. The serving man filled the second cup, then started toward a corner of the tent. But Luna said,
"That will be all for now, Mentual."
The stocky man hesitated, eyeing Karid, before making a bow to Luna, touching eyes and lips with his fingertips and departing.
"Mantual is overprotective of me," Luna explained.
Clearly he did not want to explain, but he did want to avoid what might be taken for open insult.
"Odd fellow. Attached himself to me years ago, in Pujili. Wormed his way into becoming my manservant. I think he'd stay if I stopped paying him."
"Yes, very close kin to Ajimbura."
For a time they simply sipped cough, balancing the cups on fingertips and enjoying the pungent bitterness. It seemed to be a pure Ijaz Mountains brew, and if so, very expensive. Kareed's own supply of black beans, most definitely not Ijaz Mountains, had run out a week ago, and he had been surprised at how much he missed having cough. He never used to mind going without anything at need. The first cups done, Luna refilled them.
"You were going to tell me about the difficulties?" Kareed prompted, now that conversation would not be impolite.
He always tried to be polite, even with men he was going to kill, and rudeness here would dam up the man's tongue.
Luna set his cup down and leaned his fists on the table, frowning at the map.
Small red wedges supporting tiny paper banners were scattered across it, marking Seanchan forces on the move, and red stars indicating forces holding in place. Little black disks marking engagements peppered the map, but strangely, no white disks to indicate the enemy. None.
"Over the last week," Luna said, "there have been 4 sizable engagements and upwards of 60 ambushes, skirmishes, and raids. Many quite large, all spread out across 300 miles.
That encompassed almost the entire map. His voice was stiff. Plainly given a choice, he would have told Kareed nothing. That half-step gave him none, however.
"There must be 6 or 8 different armies involved on the other side. The night after the first large engagement saw 9 major raids, each 40 to 50 miles from the site of the battle. Not small armies, either, or at least not taken altogether. But we can't find them, and nobody has any eyeless idea where they came from. Whoever they are, they have Damani, those Aes Sedai, with them, and maybe those cursed Ashaman. Men have been torn apart by explosions our Damani say weren't caused by the power."
Kareed sipped his cough. The man was not thinking. If the enemy had Aes Sedai and Ashaman, they could use a thing called traveling to move as far as they wished in a step. But if they could do that, why had they not used it to step all the way to safety with their prize? Perhaps not all Aes Sedai and Ashaman could travel, yet that begged another question. Why had they not sent those who could? Maybe the only Aes Sedai were the Damani stolen from the Terrasen Palace. Reportedly, none of them had had any idea how to travel. That made sense.
"What do the prisoners say about who sent them?"
Luna's laugh was bitter.
"Before you can have eyeless prisoners, you need an eyeless victory. What we've had are a string of eyeless defeats."
Picking up his cup, he took a sip. His voice loosened as if he had forgotten the colors of Kareed's armor. He was just a soldier talking his trade now.
"Gurat thought he had some of them 2 days ago. He lost 4 banners of horse and 5 of foot almost to the last man. Not all dead, but most of the wounded are the next thing to it, pin-cushioned with crossbow bolts. Mostly Tarabanners and Amadisians, but that isn't supposed to matter, is it? Had to be 20,000 or more crossbowmen to put out that volume. 30,000, maybe. And yet they managed to hide from the Marat Rakan. I know we've killed some, the reports claim it, at least. But they don't even leave their dead behind. Some fools have begun whispering that we're fighting spirits."
Fools he might consider them, but the fingers of his left hand hooked in a sign to ward off evil.
"I'll tell you one thing I know, Kareed. Their commanders are very good. Very, very good. Every man to face them has been fought off his feet, outmaneuvered and outfought completely."
Kareed nodded thoughtfully. He had speculated that the White Tower must have tasked one of its best to kidnap the High Lady Tuon,
but he had not been thinking along the lines of what people this side of the ocean called the great captains. Perhaps Tom Maryland's real name was Agilmar Jigad, or Gareth Bryn. He looked forward to meeting the man, not least to ask him how he had known she would be coming to Abu Dhar. He might hide Surath's involvement, but then again he might not. On the heights, today's ally could be tomorrow's sacrifice. Except for the gardeners, the Death Watch guards were Dacovale to the Empress herself, might she live forever, yet they lived on the heights.
There must be some plan for finding them and pinning them. Are you in charge of it?
No, praise be to the light, Luna said fervently.
He took a long drink as though wishing it were brandy.
General Chison is bringing his entire army back through the Melvidi Narrows. Apparently the Terrasen Palace decided this was important enough to risk thrusts out of Mirandi or Andor, though from what I've heard, neither one is capable of striking at anyone at the moment. I just have to wait here until Chison arrives. We'll see a different result then, I think. More than half Chison's men will be veterans from home.
Abruptly, Luna seemed to recall who he was talking to. His face turned to dark wood, a hard mask. It did not matter. Kareed was convinced this was the work of Marilyn or whatever his name was. And he knew why the man was doing what he was doing. Under different circumstances, he would have told Luna his reasoning, but the High Lady would not be safe until she was back in the Terrasen Palace among those who knew her face. If the man failed to believe him on the key point, that she was the High Lady, he would have increased her danger for nothing.
I thank you for the cough, he said, setting the cup down and taking up his helmet and gauntlets. The light see you safe, Luna. We will meet in Shandar some day. The lights see you safe, Kareed, Luna said after a moment, plainly surprised by the polite farewell. We will meet in Shandar some day.
The man had shared Karf, and Kareed had no quarrel with him. Why should he be surprised? Kareed did not speak to Masenge until they had ridden out of the camp, the Ogier gardeners striding along just ahead of the human guards. Hartha was walking on Kareed's other side, his long axe propped on his shoulder, his head nearly level with theirs.
We head northeast, he said, for the Melvidi Narrows.
If he remembered the maps correctly, and he seldom forgot any map he had more than glimpsed, they could reach it in 4 days.
The light shine on us that we arrive before the High Lady.
If they did not, the pursuit would continue, all the way to Tar Valon, if necessary. The thought of turning back without the High Lady never occurred to him. If he had to bring her out of Tar Valon, he would.
Chapter 35 The Importance of Dailan. They want safe conduct? Elaine said incredulously. To enter Camelin? Lightning flashed outside the windows, and thunder boomed. Outside, a deluge fell on Camelin, a hammering downpour. The sun must have been well above the horizon, but the stand lamps were lit against twilight darkness. The slender young man standing in front of her low-backed chair colored with embarrassment, yet he continued to look her in the eye. He was little more than a boy, really, his smooth cheeks likely shaved as much for form as because he needed a razor very often. Very properly, Hansel Renshar, Arathella's grandson, wore neither sword nor armor, but the marks of breastplate straps remained on his green coat, imprinted by long wear. A large damp spot on his left shoulder showed where his cloak had leaked through. Odd, the things you noticed at times like this.
I was instructed to ask for it, my lady, he said, his voice steady.
Dailan, arms folded beneath her breasts, grunted sourly. She was not far from scowling. Mistress Harfour, resplendent as always in her crimson tabard, with the white lion spotless on her formidable bosom, sniffed audibly. Hansel colored again. They were in Elaine's smaller sitting room, where a small fire on the marble hearth took away most of the morning's chill, and lamp oil scented the air with roses. She wished Birgitta was there.
From the mild irritation flowing through the bond, she was dealing with reports. Her annoyance was not great enough for it to be anything more urgent. The arrival of Luan and the others below the city 2 days ago with their 60,000 armsmen had occasioned more than a little excitement and impromptu celebrations in the streets by the citizens, once it became clear they were not going to occupy the camps abandoned when Jared Sarand left, taking with him men from houses that now sided with Elaine, though they could not know it yet. The light only knew what trouble that bloody man was going to cause. But Hansel's message put a new complexion on the huge encampment just a mile south of Low Camelin. If Arathella, Luan, and the others knew about the city being supplied from Tyr and Ilion through gateways, and surely everyone in Andor knew by this time, perhaps they had decided a siege would accomplish nothing. Safe conduct was a matter of battle lines. Perhaps they intended to call for Camelin's surrender to avoid a grand assault. The proclamations of support, carried by kinswomen rather than riders, had been posted from Arangil to the mining villages in the Mountains of Mist, or soon would be. But even with Sumiko and other kinswomen wearing themselves out in healing, the armsmen of Cairn, Anshar, and Baran, who had not been carried off by Jared, did not bring her numbers anywhere near 60,000. Small bands of armsmen were beginning to flow into the city as word spread that it was safe to approach Camelin, but not enough yet. It might be a week or more before sizable parties appeared. Those had been staying clear of the city for fear of Aramilla's army. The outcome of a massive assault was not a foregone conclusion. Men atop a wall had considerable advantage over those trying to scale it, but it would be a near-run thing at best, and no hope for more help soon. Dailin had paid another visit to Danine Kandreid in the west, but the woman still dithered. Elaine had 9 houses where she needed 10. Everything hung in the balance, and Danine could not bloody decide whether or not to stand for Trakand. "Why do they wish to speak with me?" She managed to keep Birgitta's irritation from tinging her voice. Birgitta's and her own. Hansel reddened yet again. He seemed to do that easily. Burn her, they truly had sent a boy. "I was not informed, my lady. I was simply told to ask for safe conduct." He hesitated. "They will not enter Camelin without it, my lady." Rising, she went to her writing desk, removed a smooth sheet of good white paper from the rosewood paper box, and dipped a pen in the silver-mounted crystal ink jar. Precise letters flowed onto the page without her usual flourishes. She was short and to the point. "Lord Luan Norwellan, Lady Arathella Renshar, Lord Pelivar Coelan, Lady Aemlyn Carand, Lady Elorian Tremaine and Lord Abella Pendar may feel safe in entering Camelin and be assured that they and their retinues may depart the city at any time they wish. I will receive them informally this afternoon in the Grand Hall as befits their stations. We must speak of the Borderlanders. Elaine Trakand, daughter heir of Andor, high seat of House Trakand." She tried to maintain calm, but the steel nib dug into the paper with the last letters. Safe conduct. She channeled the ceiling candle alight, and her hand trembled as she dribbled golden yellow wax onto the page. They implied she would try to hold them by force. No, more than implied. They as good as said it. She pressed her seal, a blossoming lily, into the wax as if trying to drive it through the tabletop. "Here," she said, handing the sheet to the young man. Her voice was ice, and she made no effort to warm it. "If this fails to make them feel safe, perhaps they might try wrapping themselves in swaddling." Thunder boomed for punctuation. He colored once more, this time plainly in anger, but wisely confined himself to offering thanks as he folded the page. He was carefully tucking it inside his coat when Mistress Harfour showed him out. She would escort him to his horse personally. A messenger from nobles as powerful as Luan and the others had to be given a certain level of honor. Suddenly Elaine's anger turned to sadness. She could not have said what she was sad over. Her moods often seemed to change without cause, perhaps for all those who had died and all those who would. "Are you certain you don't want to be queen, Dailin? Luan and that lot would stand for you in a heartbeat, and if I stand for you, those who've stood for me will stand with me. Burn me, Danine would probably stand for you." Dailin took a chair, spreading her blue skirts carefully before answering. "I'm absolutely certain. Running my own house is work enough for me without adding all of Andor to it. Besides, I disapprove of the throne changing houses without good cause. The lack of a daughter heir, or worse, one who's a fool or incompetent, cruel or greedy. You're none of those things. Continuity provides stability, and stability brings prosperity. She nodded. She liked that turn of phrase. Mind, had you died before returning to Camelin and making your claim, I would have entered my own. But the simple truth is, you'll make a better ruler than I would. Better for Andor. In part, that's because of your connection to the Dragon Reborn. Dylan's raised eyebrow invited Elaine to expound on that connection. But in large part, she went on when Elaine said nothing, it's you yourself. I watched you grow up, and by the time you were 15, I knew you'd be a good queen, perhaps as good as Andor has ever had. Elaine's face grew hot, and tears welled in her eyes. Burn her bouncing moods! Only she knew she could not blame her pregnancy this time. Praise from Dylan was like praise from her mother, never grudging, but never given unless she felt it was deserved. Her morning was busy, and she had only Camelin and the palace to deal with rather than all of Andor. Mistress Harfour reported that the spies in the palace who could be confirmed as reporting to Aramilla or her allies had grown very quiet and still, like mice that feared a cat might be watching. At least it's safe to dismiss them now, my lady, Rena said in tones of great satisfaction. She disliked having spies in the royal palace as much as Elaine did, perhaps more. Daughter heir or queen might live in the palace, but in the first maid's eyes, it belonged to her. All of them. Spies for others had been left in place so that no one would suspect that Rena knew. Keep them all on and continue to watch them, Elaine told her. They're the most likely to take coin from someone else, and we know who they are. A spy who was known could be kept from learning anything they should not, and you could make sure they learned exactly what you wanted them to. That went for the Aja eyes and ears Mistress Harfour had uncovered, too. The Ajas had no right to spy on her, and if she occasionally spoon-fed them false information, it would be their own fault if they acted on it. She could not do that too often, or they would realize she had uncovered their spies, but she could at need. As you say, my lady, the world has changed, hasn't it? I'm afraid it has, Mistress Harfour. The round woman nodded sadly, but she quickly returned to business. One of the windows in the Grand Hall has developed a leak, my lady. I'd have seen to anything minor without bothering you, but this is a crack in the glass, which means calling in... The list of problems that needed Elaine's approval and papers that needed her signature went on. Master Nari reported on wagon loads of grain and beans and trade goods in that dusty voice of his, and announced with some surprise that the number of arsons had not decreased. 17 buildings had burned in the night. He had been sure the capture of Aramilla would see an end to that, and he was rueful over being wrong. He brought death warrants in the names of Rhys Abalaman and Aldred Gomeisen for her to sign and seal. Mercenaries who turned their colors could expect no more unless their new masters prevailed. Everard Cordwyn had died at the gate, or he would have gone to the gallows too. Hafeen Bakovan had sent a petition asking a reward for his actions at the Farmadding gate, yet that was easy enough to reject. The presence of the Damani mercenary and his men might well have been the difference in the gate holding until Dylan arrived, but they had been earning their pay. No more. The prisoners are still being close-mouthed, I fear, Nori said, sliding the refused petition back into his leather folder. He seemed to feel that if he did that quickly enough, it was the same as never having removed it. The dark friend Aes Sedai, I mean, my lady. And the other two. Very close-mouthed, except for, invective. Melar is the worst with that. Shouting about what he intends to do to the women who arrested him. Denny had taken her instructions literally. The guardswomen had pummeled Melar severely, leaving him a mass of bruises from head to foot. But the Aes Sedai can be quite, vituperative as well. I fear it may be necessary to put them to the question if we hope to learn anything useful. Don't call them Aes Sedai, she snapped. Hearing Aes Sedai linked with Dark Friend made her stomach writhe. Those women have given up any right to be called Aes Sedai. She had taken their great serpent rings herself and had them melted down. That was Egwene's prerogative, not hers, and she might well be reprimanded for it, but she could not restrain herself. Ask the Lady Sylvaise for the use of her secretary. She had no questioners among her people, and according to Avienda, an unskilled questioner was likely to kill the one being put unsuccessfully to the question. When was her sister going to be allowed to visit? Light she missed Avienda. I suspect he's no such thing. Lightning lit up the windows of the sitting room, the glassed casements rattling with the boom of its thunder. Nori pressed his fingertips together, holding the folder against his ink-stained tabard with the heels of his hands, and frowning gravely. Few people keep a private questioner, my lady. It suggests, a dark side. But then, as I understand matters, her grandfather chased away every man who showed interest in her until men stopped showing interest, and she has been virtually a prisoner since reaching her majority. That would tend to give anyone a dark view of the world. She may not, be as trustworthy as you could wish, my lady. Do you think you can bribe some of her servants to be my eyes and ears? How easy it was to ask that. Spies had become a part of her life, as much as masons or glaziers. That should be possible, my lady. I will know for certain in a day or two. Once he would have been horrified by the very idea of having anything to do with spying. All things changed eventually, it seemed. His hands shifted on the folder, almost but not quite opening it. I fear the sewers in the southern part of the new city need attention urgently. Elaine sighed. Not everything changed. Burn her. Once she did have all of Andor, she suspected she would seldom have an hour to herself. What did Luan and the others want? Not long after mid-morning, Melfane Dawlish appeared and had Asanda and Nerys strip Elaine to the skin so she could be weighed in a huge wooden-armed balance scale the midwife had brought along, a daily ritual. The brass pan was padded with a blanket, thank the light. The stout little woman listened to her heart through a hollow wooden tube pressed to her chest and back, thumbed back her eyelids to examine her eyes, and smelled her breath. She had Elaine make water, then held the glass jar up to the light of a stand lamp to study it. She smelled that, too, and even dipped a finger in and licked it. It was another daily ritual. Elaine averted her eyes, pulling her flower-embroidered silk robe tight around her, but she still shuddered. This time Melfane noticed. I can tell some sickness from changes in the taste, my lady. Anyway, there's worse things. My boy Jame, the one who carried the scale for me, his first paid job of work was mucking out in a stable. He claimed everything he ate tasted like... Her round belly shook with laughter. Well, you can imagine, my lady. Elaine could, and was glad she was not prone to nausea. She shuddered again, anyway. Asanda seemed quite composed, hands folded at her waist and watching her niece with approval, but Nerys looked about to sick up. Pity he can't learn my craft, but no one would buy herbs from a man, or have a man midwife. Melfane laughed uproariously at that ridiculous notion. Wants to be apprentice to an armorer, of all things. Old for it, but there it is. Now you be sure to read to your babe. She was more than doubtful of Elaine's claim that she would have a boy and a girl. She would not accept it until she could hear their heartbeats, and that would be some few weeks yet. And have musicians play for her. She'll learn the sound of your voice. Learn to like reading and music, too. It helps in other ways, besides. Makes the child brighter. You say that every time, Mistress Dawlish, Elaine said peevishly. I can remember, you know, and I am doing it. Melfane laughed again, a twinkle in her dark eyes. She accepted Elaine's bouncing moods the way she accepted the rain and lightning. You'd be surprised how many don't believe a babe in the womb can hear, but I can see the difference in those who get read to and those who don't. Do you mind if I have a few words with my aunt before I go, my lady? I brought her a pie and an ointment for her joints. Asanda's face reddened. Well, now that her lie was exposed, she would accept healing or Elaine would know the reason why. At the end of the midday meal, Elaine brought up the intentions of Luan and the others with Birgitta. It was a wonderful meal, and she ate ravenously. Melfane had lambasted the cooks and every other woman in earshot for the bland diet they'd been feeding her. Today there were small pond trout grilled to perfection, cabbage rolls stuffed with crumbly white ewe's milk cheese, broad beans with pine nuts, and a tangy apple tart. Another reason it was marvelous was that nothing had the faintest hint of spoiling. To drink, there was good black tea with mint that made her tense for a moment, until she realized it really was mint. The only thing Melfane had forbidden was wine, however well watered. Birgitta had even given up drinking herself, though it seemed impossible it could have any effect through the bond. Elaine refrained from pointing that out. Birgitta had been drinking too much to dull the pain of losing her guidel. Elaine understood, even if she did not approve. She could not imagine what she would do if Rand died. "I don't know," Birgitta said after wolfing down the last of her tart. "My best guess is they've come to ask you to help them move against the Borderlanders. The one bloody thing that's sure is that they didn't bloody come to throw their support to you."
"That's my best guess, too."
Elaine picked up crumbs of cheese with a damp fingertip and popped them into her mouth. She could have eaten as much again as had been on her plate, but Melfane had announced her strict intention to limit her weight gain. Just enough and not too much. Perhaps a cow being fattened for market felt like this. "Unless they're going to demand I surrender Camelin."
"There's always that," Birgitta said, sounding almost cheerful. The bond said she was anything but.
"We still have watchers in the towers, though, and Julania and Karyla have gotten work as laundresses in their camp, so we'll know if they begin to move against the city before the first man sets out."
Elaine wished she did not sigh so often.
Burn her, she had Aramilla, Nayan, and Elania under guard and definitely not enjoying sharing a bed. She knew the thought should not give her pleasure, but it did. And she had gained 3 more allies, if not necessarily the most solid. At least they were tied to her inextricably now. She should have been feeling triumphant. That afternoon, Esunda and Sephany dressed her in dark green slashed with emerald on the skirts and embroidered with silver across the bosom, down the sleeves and around the hem. For jewelry, she wore her great serpent ring and a large silver pin enameled blue, except for the shape of Trakan's keystone. The pin made her morose. Inside the house, it was said that Trakand was the keystone that held Andor together. She had not done a very good job of it so far. She and Birgitta took turns reading aloud to her babes. From histories, of course. If Melfane was right, she did not want to direct them to frivolous tales. Dry stuff it was. A plump man in red and white played the flute, while a lean woman in livery played the 12-string bittern, producing lively, joyous tunes, at least when crashes of thunder did not drown them out. Bards did not grow on trees, and Birgitta had been uncertain about allowing anyone from outside the palace near Elaine, but Mistress Harfour had found a number of accomplished musicians who had leapt at the chance to put on livery. Their pay was considerably better in the palace than in a common room, and their clothing was provided with it. Elaine thought of trying to hire a gleeman, but that made her think of Tom. Was he dry? Was he even alive? All she could do was pray. The lights send it so. Please. Mistress Harfour came to announce the arrival of Luan, Arathella, and the others, and Elaine donned the coronet of the daughter heir, a simple gold band that held a single golden rose surrounded by thorns above her brows. Kassela, along with 8 guardswomen, fell in behind her, Birgitta, and Asanda as they left her apartments, boots thudding loudly on the floor tiles in step. 9 guardswomen had been among the dead when she was rescued from the Dark Friends, and that seemed to have bonded the others together even more tightly. They got lost twice, finding their way to the Grand Hall, but no one so much as murmured. What were shifting corridors when you had faced power-wrought fire and lightning? The great arch doors of the Grand Hall, carved with tall lions on both sides, stood open, and Kassela took the guardswomen to stand in front of them, while she, Birgitta, and Asanda went in. The tall windows in the walls were dark with rain, except when lightning flashed, but the mirrored stand lamps against the walls and around the white columns that marched in rows along the sides of the chamber were all lit. A loud, steady plunk, plunk, plunk echoed in the vast space,
drops falling into a prosaic wooden bucket, standing beneath one of the colored windows set in the ceiling 20 paces overhead, where one of the rearing white lions had beads of water glistening along a crack, near scenes of battle and the faces of Andor's earliest queens. As always in this hall, Elaine felt those women judging her as she crossed the red and white floor tiles. They had built Andor with the sharpness of their minds and the blood of their sons and husbands, beginning with a single city and molding a strong nation out of the rubble of Arthur Hawkwing's empire. They had a right to judge any woman who sat on the Lion Throne. She suspected their visages had been placed there so every queen would feel her actions judged by history. The throne itself sat atop a white marble dais at the far end of the chamber, carved and gilded and sized for a woman, yet massive on its lion-pawed legs. The white lion, formed from moonstones set in a field of glittering rubies on its tall back, would stand above the head of the tallest woman who sat on that throne. Dailin was already standing at the foot of the dais's steps, watching Sylvace converse with Conyle and Catelyn, while Branlett and Perivale listened closely. Perivale raked his fingers through his hair and nodded. Did Dailin have questions about Sylvace, too? Lear and Karin stood apart from the rest, and apart from each other as well. Neither even glanced at the other. Having been allies against Elaine, they would not want her to think they were allied still. Asanda went to join the serving men and women in the liveries of the 8 other houses, gathered around a table that held tall silver pitchers of wine and tea. That was what informal meant in this context. Each of them would bring a single servant in attendance. For a formal meeting, Elaine would have provided all of the servants, and the grand hall would have been crowded with every noble in Camelin, every noble from the encampment below Camelin. "Elorian may well be provocative, Elaine," Dailin said for about the 5th time since hearing of the safe conduct request. Her face was cool and calm, yet she must have been feeling her nerves. Her hands smoothed unnecessarily at her gold-embroidered skirts. "I won't let her provoke me," Elaine replied. "Neither will anyone else. I mean you, Conyle, and you, Lear." Conyle, in gold-worked blue, colored as quickly as Hansel had. He had gotten into a fight with a mercenary he thought had spoken disparagingly of Elaine and had almost killed the man. It was well for him the other man had begun drawing his sword first. Even mercenaries deserved justice, and Andor was not Tyr, where nobles could kill commoners with impunity. Well, before Rand changed so many of their laws. Burn him, why was he leaping about so? "I stood for you, Elaine, and that means I always stand up for you," Lear said smoothly. He looked every inch the self-confident courtier in silver-embroidered green silk with House Barin's silver-winged hammer on the collar, yet he was too smooth by half, Lear was. "But I'll hold my temper, whatever Elorian says." The bond surged with fleeting contempt. Trying to demonstrate how loyal he was to Elaine, Lear had fought with mercenaries 3 times. In 2 days. The man had to have been searching for fights to manage that. "If she tries to goad us, why should we bite our tongues?" Catelyn demanded. Her red dress, embroidered with broad bands of gold at the hem and on the sleeves, did not suit her coloring, especially when her plump cheeks were crimson with anger. Her chin was raised. Perhaps she wore that large enameled pin bearing Haven's blue bear where she did, so she would be forced to keep her chin high and look down her nose at everyone. "I've never allowed anyone to poke at me and walk away unscathed." "An ox responds to the goad and does as the ox herd wants," Dailin said dryly. "The same way you will be doing what Elorian wants if you respond to her goads." The crimson remained in Catelyn's cheeks, no doubt from embarrassment now. Rena Harfor appeared in the doorway. "My ladies," she said loudly, her voice echoing in the nearly empty chamber. "My lords." This was informality, when 2 sides met, and there was no knowing how far apart they were. Mistress Harfor announced the newly arrived lords and ladies in strict order of precedence, though among the houses gathered here there was not a great deal between them. Luan Norwellen, hard-faced and more gray-haired than when Elaine last saw him, his blue coat undecorated except for Norwellen's silver salmon on the high collar. Arathella Renshaw, her face creased and her brown hair thick with gray, in a red riding dress ornately worked with gold, and a large ruby-studded pin that displayed the three golden hounds. Pellavar Coelan, tall and lean, his dark hair receding till he almost looked as if he had shaved the front of his head like a Kyrianon, in silver-embroidered blue with twinned red roses worked on his collar, the roses of Coelan. Aemlyn Carand, plump in grey silk, with the three golden arrows climbing her sleeves, and so thick on her bosom she looked like a bristling quiver. Elorian Tremaine, not so plump as Elaine recalled, but still pretty in green-slashed blue embroidered with golden-antlered white stags, the white stag of Tremaine on the sleeves. Abella Pendar, his angular face stern beneath grey hair, in dark grey with the three golden stars on his collar. They walked up the grand hall together, trailed by their servants, but not grouped as announced. Elorian and Abella walked with Luon, Pellavar and Aemlyn with Arathella, two paces between the groups. So, they asked for safe conduct as one, yet they were not one. That made a demand for surrender a little less likely. Even open enemies could act in concert at times. Divided skirts and snug breeches glistened damply. The finest cloak could not protect a person completely in a downpour like this. They would not be in their best tempers. "Be welcome," she told them as their servants peeled away to join the others. "Will you take wine or tea? The wine is hot and spiced. This seems a wintry day for spring." Luon opened his mouth, but Elorian spoke first. "At least you're not sitting on the throne." Her face might have been carved from marble, and her voice was that hard and cold. "I half expected you to be." Thunder rolled overhead. Luon looked pained. Arathella rolled her eyes as if she were hearing something she had heard all too often before. Lear stirred, but Elaine fixed him with a steady look, and he gave a small apologetic bow. "I have no right to sit on the throne, Elorian," she replied calmly. "Light, please let her mood hold steady now." "Yet." There was an unintended touch of bite in that. Perhaps she was not so calm as she wished to be. Elorian sneered. "If you're waiting for Daneen to make your 10, you'll have a long wait. Daneen spent the last succession visiting her manors. She never declared for anyone." Elaine smiled, but it was difficult. A succession was when one house succeeded another on the throne. "I will have tea." Elorian blinked, but it sparked the others to announce what they would take. Only Elaine, Birgitta, Branlett, and Perival took tea. Everyone sniffed at their cups, whether silver cups of wine or porcelain teacups, before taking a sip. Elaine felt no insult. Food and wine could be fine in the kitchens, and tainted by the time it reached the table. There was never any telling where or when spoilage would strike. The tea had a faint tang of ginger, but not enough to overwhelm the taste of good Tremalking black. "I see you've gathered most of your support among the children and Aramilla's leavings," Elorian said. Catalin turned as red as her dress, and Branlett straightened angrily until Perival put a hand on his arm and shook his head. A level-headed boy, Perival, and bright beyond his years. Lear managed to restrain himself this time, but Conail started to say something sharp before Elaine's firm look snapped his teeth shut. Carind merely returned Elorian's spiteful stare stolidly. Carind was not very intelligent, but little ruffled her. "You must have had a reason for asking this meeting," Elaine said. "If it was merely to offer insults..." She let that trail off. She had her own reasons for wanting this meeting. If they had asked for her to come to them, she would have, without asking for safe conduct. Feeling a pulse of anger through the bond, she took a firm rein on hers. Birgitta wore a scowl directed at Elorian like a dagger. If they began feeding one another's temper... That did not bear thinking about, not here, not now. Elorian opened her mouth again, and this time Luon cut her off. "We've come to ask for a truce, Elaine." A flash of lightning lit the northern windows and those in the ceiling, but the interval to thunder said it had been some distance off. A truce? Are we at war, Luan? Has someone declared for the throne that I haven't heard of? Six sets of eyes swung to Dialin, who grunted. Fools! I told you, and you wouldn't believe me. Perhaps you'll believe this. When Sylvaes, Carand, and Lear sent their proclamations of support, I sent my own. Taravin stands for Trakand, and the whole of Andor will know it soon enough. Elorian colored angrily and managed to make even that seem cold. Aemlyn took a long drink, looking thoughtful. Arathella allowed a touch of disappointment to touch her face before it returned to a mask nearly as hard as Elorian's.
"Be that as it may," Luan said. "We still want, if not a truce, then a temporary agreement."
He drank a small swallow from his wine cup and shook his head sadly.
"Even gathering everything we can, we'll have a difficult time defeating the Borderlanders. But if we fail to act together, they'll carve up Andor once they decide to move. Frankly, I'm surprised they've remained in one place this long. Their men ought to be well rested by now, even after a 1,000-league march."
Lightning lit the southern windows brightly, and thunder crashed so loudly it seemed the glass panes should shiver. Close, that one.
"I expected them to be in Temurundi by now myself," Elaine said. "But I believe their reason for sitting in one place is a fear of sparking a war if they come too near Camelin. They seem to be trying to find a way to Murundi using country roads. You know what condition those are in this time of year. They want no war with us. When I gave them permission to cross Andor, they told me they were looking for the dragon reborn."
Elorian spluttered, and chips of ice should have come from her mouth.
"When you what? You prate of how you have no right to sit on the throne yet, and then you arrogate to yourself the right of an Aes Sedai, Elorian."
Elaine held up her right hand so they could not miss the golden great serpent encircling the third finger. Her own voice was frosty despite all she could do.
"I did not speak as daughter heir or even high seat of House Trakand. I spoke as Elaine Aes Sedai of the Green Aja. Had I not, they would have come anyway. They were very short of food and fodder. Had I tried to stop them, had anyone tried to stop them, there would have been war. They are determined to find the dragon reborn. It would have been a war Andor had faint chance of winning. You speak of acting together, Luan? Gather all of Andor's strength, and we could nearly match their numbers. But 2 in 3 of ours would be men who can handle a halberd or spear but spend most of their days behind a plough. Every man of theirs is a long-serving armsman who would not be surprised to face Trollocs any day of his life. Instead of a war that would soak Andor in blood and cripple her for a generation, we have the Borderlanders crossing our nation peacefully. I have them watched. They pay for the food and fodder they need, and pay well."
Another time, with other listeners, she would have laughed over that. Andoran farmers would try to pry high prices out of the Dark One. "The worst they've done is flog a few horse thieves, and if they should have been handed over to a magistrate, I can't fault the Borderlanders far for it. Now tell me, Elorian, what would you have done differently, and how?" Elorian blinked, icily sullen, then sniffed dismissively and sipped at her wine.
"And what do you plan for this Black Tower?" Abella asked quietly. "I suspect you have a plan for them, too."
Did he suspect her other reason for letting the Borderlanders cross Andor?
Let him, so long as he did not give it voice. So long as he kept silent, her motive seemed purely for Andor's good.
That was hypocritical, no bones about it, but realistic as well. She had spoken truthfully concerning her other reasons, but that one, spoken aloud, could cost her. She still needed one more house, and it looked as if Candreid had to be it, but Danine would never move if she thought Elaine was trying to force her into it.
"Nothing," she told him. "I send guardsmen periodically to ride around the Black Tower grounds and remind them they are in Andor and subject to Andor's laws, but aside from that, I can do no more than I could if the White Tower were somehow transported to Camelin." For a long moment they stared at her, all six of them unblinking. "Pandar stands for Trakand," Abella said suddenly, and right atop him, Luan said, "Norwellen stands for Trakand." Lightning flashed overhead, brightening the colored windows in the ceiling. Elaine kept herself from swaying with an effort. Birgitta's face was smooth, but the bond carried amazement. It was done. She had 11, and the throne was hers. "The more who stand for her, the better for Andor," Dialin sounded a touch dazed herself. "Stand with me for Trakand." There was another pause, longer, full of exchanged glances, but then, one by one, Arathella, Pellavar, and Aemlyn announced that their houses stood for Trakand. Doing so for Dialin, though. Elaine would have to remember that. Perhaps she could win their loyalty in time, but for the present they supported her for Dialin's sake. "She has the throne," Elorian said, as cold as ever. "The rest is fluff and feathers." Elaine tried to make her voice warm. "Will you dine with us this evening, Elorian? At least remain until the rain abates." "I have my own cooks," Elorian replied, turning away toward the doors. Her serving woman came running to take her cup and return it to the table. "As soon as the rain stops, I will be leaving for Sheldon. I've been away too long." "Tarman Gaiden is coming soon, Elorian," Elaine said. "You won't be able to remain on your estates then." Elorian paused, looking over her shoulder. "When Tarman Gaiden comes, Tremaine rides for the last battle, and we ride behind the Lion of Andor." Thunder boomed as she strode out of the grand hall with her serving woman at her heels. "Will you all join me in my apartments?" Elaine asked the others. Behind the Lion of Andor, but not a word about behind Elaine Trakand. Nearly half her support was suspect one way or another. Jared Sarand was still on the loose with a not inconsiderable force, and she would have trouble from Elorian eventually. It was never this way in stories. In stories, everything was always wrapped up neatly by the end. Real life was much messier. Still, she had the throne at last. There was still the coronation, but that was a formality now. As she led the procession from the grand hall, chatting with Luan and Pellavar, thunder rolled overhead like martial drums beating the march for Tarman Gaiden. How long before Andor's banners had to march to the last battle?
Chapter 36. Under an Oak. The sun stood well above the mountains as Kareed rode through the trees toward the so-called Malvidi Narrows, perhaps 2 leagues ahead. The 5-mile-wide gap in the mountains carried the road from Ebudar to Lugard, 1 mile south of him. Well short of the narrows, though, he would find the camp Ajimbura had located for him. Ajimbura had not been fool enough to try entering the camp, so Kareed still did not know whether he was riding into a death trap for nothing. No, not for nothing. For the High Lady Tuan. Any Death Watch guard was ready to die for her. Their honor was duty, and duty often meant death. The sky held only billowing white clouds with no threat of rain. He had always hoped to die in sunlight. He had brought just a small party. Ajimbura on his white-footed chestnut to show the way, of course. The wiry little man had cut off his white-streaked red braid, a measure of his great devotion. The hill tribes took these braids as trophies from those they killed in their endless feuds, and to be without one was to be disgraced in the eyes of all the tribes and families, a self-proclaimed coward. That devotion was to Kareed, rather than the High Lady or the Crystal Throne, but Kareed's own devotion was such that it came to the same thing. 2 of the guards rode at Kareed's back, their red and green armor buffed till it shone, like his own. Hartha and a pair of gardeners strode along with their long hafted axes on their shoulders, easily keeping pace with the horses. Their armor glistened as well. Melatine, the High Lady's Dersuldam, her long graying hair tied with a bright red ribbon today, was on a high-stepping gray, the silvery length of an Adam connecting her left wrist to Mylan's neck. There had been little that could be done to make those two appear more impressive, but the Adam and Melatine's blue dress, the red panels on skirts and bosom, holding silver forked lightning bolts, should draw the eye. Taken altogether, no one should notice Ajimbura at all. The rest were back with Musenge, in case it truly was a death trap. He had considered using another Demani than Mylan. The tiny woman with the face he could never put an age to almost bounced in her saddle with eagerness to lay eyes on the High Lady again. She was not properly composed. Still, she could do nothing without Melitene, and she was useless as a weapon, a fact that had made her hang her head when he pointed it out to the Deir Suldam. She had needed consoling, her Suldam petting her and telling her what beautiful skylights she made, how wonderful her healing was. Even thinking about that made Kareed shudder. Taken in the abstract, it might seem a wonderful thing, wounds undone in moments, but he thought he would need to be near death before he would let anyone touch him with the power. And yet, if it could have saved his wife Kalia... No. The weapons had been left with Musenge. If there was a battle today, it would be of a different sort. The first bird call he heard seemed no different from others he had heard that morning, but it was repeated ahead and then again. Just one call each time. He spotted a man up in tall oak with a crossbow that tracked him as he rode. Seeing him was not easy. His breastplate and open-faced helmet were painted a dull green that faded into the tree's foliage. A length of red cloth tied around his left arm helped, though. If he really wanted to hide, he should have removed that. Kareed motioned to Ajumbura, and the wiry little man grinned at him, a wizened blue-eyed rat, before allowing his chestnut to fall back behind the guards. His long knife was under his coat today. He should pass for a servant. Soon enough, Kareed was riding into the camp itself. It had no tents or shelters of any kind, but there were long horse lines laid out in orderly fashion, and many more men in green breastplates. Heads turned to watch his party pass, but few men were on their feet, and fewer held a crossbow. A fair number of them were asleep on their blankets, doubtless tired from all the hard riding they had been doing by night. So the bird call had told them he was not enough to present a danger. They had the look of well-trained soldiers, but he had expected as much. What he had not expected was how few they were. Oh, the trees might be hiding some, but surely the camp held no more than 7,000 or 8,000 men, far too few to have carried out the campaign Luna had described. He felt a sudden tightness in his chest. Where were the rest? The High Lady might be with one of the other bands. He hoped Ajumbura was taking note of the numbers. Before he had gone far, a short man mounted on a tall dun met him and reined in, where he had to stop or ride the man down. The front half of his beard was shaved, and appeared to be powdered of all things. He was no popinjay, though. His dark coat might be silk, yet he wore the same dull green breastplate as the common soldiers. His eyes were hard and expressionless as he scanned Melitene and Mylan, the Ogier. His face did not change as his gaze returned to Kareed.
"Lord Matt described that armor to us," he said, in accents even quicker and more clipped than those of the Altarans. "To what do we owe the honor of a visit from the Death Watch Guard?"
Lord Matt? Who under the light was Lord Matt?
"Furik Kareed," Kareed said. "I wish to speak with the man who calls himself Tom Marilyn." "Talmanis Delavind," the man said, finding manners. "You want to talk to Tom? Well, I see no harm in it. I will take you to him."
Kareed healed Aldazar after Delavind. The man had made no mention of the obvious, that he and the others could not be allowed to leave and carry word of this army's location. He had some manners. At least they would not be allowed to leave unless Kareed's mad plan worked. Musenge gave him only 1 chance in 10 of success, 1 in 5 of living. Personally, he himself believed the odds longer, but he had to make the attempt. And Marilyn's presence argued in favor of the High Lady's presence. Delavind dismounted at an oddly domestic scene among the trees. People on camp stools or blankets around a small fire beneath a spreading oak where a kettle was heating. Kareed stepped down from his saddle, motioning the guards and Ajumbura to dismount as well. Melitene and Mylan remained on their mounts for the advantage of height. Of all people, Mistress Annan, who had once owned the inn where he stayed in Ebu Dar, was sitting on one of the three-legged stools reading a book. She no longer wore one of those revealing dresses he had enjoyed looking at, but her close-fitting necklace still dangled that small jeweled knife onto her impressive bosom. She closed her book and gave him a small nod as if he had returned to the wandering woman after an absence of a few hours. Her hazel eyes were quite composed. Perhaps the plot was even more intricate than the seeker Moore had thought. A tall, lean, white-haired man with mustaches nearly as long as Hartha's was sitting cross-legged on a striped blanket across a stone's board from a slender woman with her hair in many beaded braids. He quirked an eyebrow at Kareed, shook his head, and returned to perusing the cross-hatched board. She glared pure hatred at Kareed and those behind him. A gnarled old fellow with long white hair was lying on another blanket with a remarkably ugly young boy, playing some game or other on a piece of red cloth spider-webbed with black lines. They sat up, the boy studying the ogier with interest, the man with one hand hovering as if to reach for a knife beneath his coat. A dangerous man and wary. Perhaps he was Marilyn. Two men and two women sitting together on camp stools had been conversing when Kareed rode up, but as he was stepping down, a stern-faced woman stood and fixed her blue eyes on his in very nearly a challenge. She wore a sword on a wide leather strap slanting across her chest, the way some sailors did. Her hair was close-cropped, rather than cut in the style of the low blood. Her fingernails were short, and none were lacquered, but he was certain she was Eginin Tamaroth. A heavy-set man with hair as short as hers and one of those odd Ilioner beards stood beside her, one hand on the hilt of a short sword, staring at Kareed as if he intended to second her challenge. A pretty woman with dark, waist-long hair and the same rosebud mouth as the Terrabonner stood, and for a moment it seemed she might kneel or prostrate herself, but then she straightened and looked him right in the eyes. The last man, a lean fellow in a peculiar red cap, who looked carved from dark wood, gave a loud laugh and flung his arms around her. The grinning stare he gave Kareed could only be called triumphant.
"Tom," Delavind said, "this is Ferrick Kareed. He wants to talk with a man who calls himself Tom Marilyn."
"With me?"
the lean white-haired man said, rising awkwardly. His right leg appeared slightly stiff. An old battle injury, perhaps?
"But I don't call myself Tom Marilyn. It's my name. Though I'm surprised you know it, what do you want of me?"
Kareed removed his helmet, but before he could open his mouth, a pretty woman with large brown eyes rushed up, pursued by two others.
All three had those Aes Sedai faces, 1 minute looking 20, the next twice that, the third somewhere in the middle.
It was very disconcerting.
"That's Shireen," the pretty woman cried, staring at Mylan. "Release her!"
"You do not understand, Jolene," one of the women with her said angrily.
Thin-lipped, with a narrow nose, she looked as if she could chew rocks.
"She do not be Shireen any longer. She would have betrayed us, given a chance."
"Teslin is right, Jolene," the third woman.
Handsome, rather than pretty, she had long black hair that fell in waves to her waist.
"She would have betrayed us."
"I don't believe it, Edesina," Jolene snapped. "You will free her immediately," she told Melitene, "or I'll—"
Suddenly she gasped.
"I did tell you," Teslin said bitterly.
A young man in a wide-brimmed black hat galloped up on a dark, blunt-nosed chestnut with a deep chest and flung himself out of the saddle.
"What's bloody going on here?" he demanded, striding up to the fire.
Kareed ignored him. The High Lady Tuon had ridden up with the young man on a black-and-white horse with markings like none he had ever seen. Seleucia was at her side on a dun, her head wrapped in a scarlet scarf, but he had eyes only for the High Lady. Short black hair covered her head, but he could never mistake that face. She spared him only one expressionless glance before returning to a study of the young man. Kareed wondered whether she recognized him. Probably not. It had been a long time since he had served in her bodyguard. He did not look over his shoulder, but he knew that the reins of Ajimbura's chestnut were now held by one of the guards. Apparently unarmed and his distinctive braid gone, he should have no problem leaving the camp. The sentries would never see the little man. Ajimbura was a good runner as well as stealthy. Soon Musenge would know that the High Lady was indeed here.
"She has shielded us, Matt," Jolene said,
and the young man snatched off his hat and strode to Melitene's horse as if he intended to seize the bridle. He was long-limbed, though he could not be called tall,
and he wore a black silk scarf tied around his neck and dangling onto his chest. That made him the one everyone had called Tylin's toy, as if being the queen's plaything were the most important feature of him. Likely it was. Playthings seldom had another side to them. Strange, but he hardly seemed handsome enough for that. He did look fit, though.
"Release the shield,"
he told her, as if he expected obedience. Kareed's eyebrows rose. This was the plaything? Melatine and Mylan gasped almost as one, and the young man barked a laugh.
"You see, it doesn't work on me. Now you bloody well release the shields, or I'll bloody well haul you out of the saddle and paddle your bottoms."
Melatine's face darkened. Few people dared speak to a Dersuldam.
"Release the shields, Melatine," Kareed said.
"The Marath Damani was on the point of embracing Sayadar," she said, instead of obeying. "There's no telling what she might have..."
"Release the shields," he said firmly, "and release the power."
The young man gave a satisfied nod, then suddenly spun, pointing a finger at the three Aes Sedai.
"Now don't you bloody well start. She's let go of the power, you do it too. Go ahead."
Again he nodded, for all the world as if he were sure they had obeyed. From the way Melatine was staring at him, perhaps he was. Maybe he was an Ashaman? Perhaps Ashaman could detect a Damani's channeling somehow. That hardly seemed likely, but it was all Kareed could think of. Yet that hardly squared with how Tylin reportedly had treated the young man.
"One of these days, Matt Cawthon," Jolene said acidly, "someone will teach you to show proper respect to Aes Sedai, and I hope I am there to see it."
The High Lady and Seleucia laughed uproariously. It was good to see she had managed to keep her spirits up in captivity. Doubtless her maid's companionship had helped. But it was time to get on, too. Time to take his mad gamble.
"General Marilyn," Kareed said, "you fought a short but remarkable campaign and achieved miracles at keeping your forces undetected. But your luck is about to run out. General Chison deduced your real purpose. He has turned his army around and is marching for the Melvidi Narrows as fast as he can. He will be here in 2 days. I have 10,000 men not far from here, enough to pin you until he arrives. But the High Lady Tuan would be in danger, and I want to avoid that. Let me leave with her, and I will allow you and your men to depart unhindered. You can be well the other side of the mountains into the Mulvane Gap before Chison arrives, and into Murundi before he can catch you. The only other choice is annihilation. Chison has enough men to wipe you out. It won't be a battle. 100,000 men against 8,000 will be a slaughter."
They heard him out, every face as blank as if they were stunned. They schooled themselves well. Or perhaps they were stunned at Marilyn's plan apparently unraveling at the last instant. Marilyn stroked one of his white mustaches with a long finger. He seemed to be hiding a smile.
"I fear you have mistaken me, Banner General Kareed."
For the space of a sentence, his voice became extremely resonant.
"I am a gleeman. A position higher than court bard, to be sure, but no general. The man you want is Lord Matram Cawthon."
He made a small bow toward the young man who was settling his flat-topped hat back on his head. Kareed frowned. Tylin's toy was the general? Were they playing a game with him?
"You have about 100 men, Death Watch guards, and maybe 20 gardeners," Cawthon said calmly. "From what I hear, that could make an even fight against 5 times their number for most soldiers. But the band aren't most soldiers, and I have a sight more than 600.
As for Chison, if that's the fellow who pulled back through the Narrows, even if he has figured out what I was up to, he couldn't get back in less than 5 days. My scout's last reports had him pushing southwest along the Ebu Dar Road as fast as he could march. The real question is this, though. Can you get Tuan to the Terrasen Palace safely?"
Kareed felt as if Hartha had kicked him in the belly,
and not only because the man had used the High Lady's name so casually.
"You mean to let me take her away?"
he said incredulously.
"If she trusts you, if you can get her to the palace safely. She's in danger till she reaches that. In case you don't know it, your whole bloody ever-victorious flaming army is ready to slit her throat or bash in her head with a rock."
"I know," Kareed said, more calmly than he felt. Why would this man just release the High Lady after the White Tower had gone to all the trouble of kidnapping her? Why, after fighting that short bloody campaign?
"We will die to the man if that is what is needed to see her safe. It will be best if we set out immediately."
Before the man changed his mind, before Kareed woke from this fever dream, it surely seemed a fever dream.
"Not so fast," Cawthon turned toward the High Lady. "Tuan, do you trust this man to see you safe to the palace in Abu Dhar?"
Kareed stifled an impulse to wince. General and lord the man might be, but he had no right to use the High Lady's name so.
"I trust the Death Watch guards with my life," the High Lady replied calmly. "And him more than any other."
She favored Kareed with a smile. Even as a child, smiles from her had been rare.
"Do you, by any chance, still have my doll, Banner General Kareed?"
He bowed to her formally. The manner of her speaking told him she was still under the veil.
"Forgiveness, High Lady. I lost everything in the great fire of Sohima."
"That means you kept it for 10 years. You have my commiseration on the loss of your wife and of your son, though he died bravely and well. Few men will enter a burning building once. He saved 5 people before he was overcome."
Kareed's throat tightened. She had followed news of him. All he could do was bow again more deeply.
"Enough of that," Cawthon muttered. "You're going to knock your head on the ground if you keep that up. As soon as she and Seleucia can get their things together, you take them out of here and ride hard. Talmanis, rouse the band. It isn't that I don't trust you, Kareed, but I think I'll sleep easier beyond the Narrows."
"Matram Cawthon is my husband," the High Lady said in a loud, clear voice.
Everyone froze where they stood.
"Matram Cawthon is my husband."
Kareed felt as if Hartha had kicked him again. No, not Hartha. Aldazar. What madness was this? Cawthon looked like a man watching an arrow fly towards his face, knowing he had no chance to dodge.
"Bloody Matram Cawthon is my husband. That is the wording you used, is it not?"
This had to be a fever dream.